Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Blog Talk Radio. Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to a very exciting show. Now, for me, what makes a really great book on science is that it makes you realize that you're kind of an idiot about a subject, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I didn't realize how little I knew about competing, what it takes to make yourself competition ready, and why competing is so essential to doing our best, until I read the book featured on tonight's show. Now, we like to simplify competing into winning versus losing, but the truth is there are numerous nuances that go into what makes a person a winner or a loser of some competition, or even in how they perform on the job. These nuances and the fascinating research behind them are what we'll be discussing tonight with New York Times bestselling science writer Ashley Merriman. Merriman is the co-author with Poe Bronson of the New York Times bestselling book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. So stick with us to learn to identify the kind of competitor you are, why some people breeze through competition and others choke, and how you can use the research on choking and competing to transform yourself to do and be the best you can. Hello, Ashley.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you so much for having me. Although I didn't know, do we get to speak in French? Because my science is in French and it's not so good.
Oh, no, my French is only good. I'm good when competing with a four-year-old, and I can only understand them. I fake it after a while. People could be saying, you know, I'm going to eat your grandmother for dinner, and I just nod and smile. So the truth of my French, it's sad. We can compete in French after the show. Now, there are those who argue that competition is something awful and evil. And these people, they see it in terms of destructiveness, and they think it kills off our more pro-social behavior, like cooperation and respect. But this, you don't think, is the case.
No, for one thing, you know, people would ask me even when I started writing the book, oh, is competition good or bad? And I was like, it is. Darwin, anyone? I mean, competition, seriously, competition is a fact of life. And I'm not advocating that everything needs to be a competition. I'm not advocating everyone needs to be cutthroat or killer and everything. But we need to understand competition's role in our lives and society so we can know when to compete and when not. And, you know, there, especially in the past, I'd say 10, 20 years, there's been this sort of buzzword, you know, oh, competition's so last century. It's all about collaboration. Well, it's a false choice between the two, right? If you and I are competing as a team, we're working together, we're collaborating, but we still want to win against the other team. Even if you and I are just competing directly head-to-head, we've still got an element of collaboration in the activity because we've agreed, I think most of the time at least, what are the rules? What are the things that we would both consider to be appropriate behavior? What are not? What are the things that are out of bounds? So even when we're competing against each other, we still have this sort of agreement. So it's a false choice to say it's competition versus collaboration. That just is not the case.
Yeah, I love how you draw that out, that collaborating, we collaborate even when we're competing head-to-head because we don't think about that. You know, when we compete, we have to choose the playing field. How are we competing? Mm-hmm. You know, whether
right.
it's at work or some other area.
Absolutely. And, you know, the sort of most famous example of collaboration is Linux. And there's this idea that it was open source coding, and all of these, you know, coders are basically holding hands, singing kumbaya as they code to build this thing. And that's totally not true. Many people may be working on a line of code, but ultimately only one person's code gets in or not. And they're fighting for the opportunity to make that edit, and once they get it there, the few who do, and we're talking like 5%, those people put it on their resume. Those people get hired. So, and even when I'm told, the creator of Linux said from the very get-go, it's about a competition, and if you're not here to win, if you're not here to give me the best code, why are you even bothering?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story, and about how people were so interested in credit, because when I've heard about Linux, you always hear, oh, open source, and you do think of the kumbaya model, you know, and you just really cut through a lot of these myths in this book. And I wanted to get into how you think that there's basically a vocabulary problem in how we view competition.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I just want to read something that you write in the book, Top Dog. And you say, we don't hesitate to say that countries should remain competitive. And you say, competitive is a compliment when describing Magic Johnson on the basketball court, but it's probably a warning sign when depicting a girlfriend's behavior during a casual night of board games. So
mm-hmm.
you make a distinction between these kinds of competition.
Well, I don't think I do. I think we as a culture do. And when people are talking about, you know, I'll ask someone, you know, are you competitive? Oh, no, I'm not competitive. Really? No, I wouldn't consider myself to be a competitive person at all. You're a lawyer. Yeah, no, you're a litigator. And people are so uncomfortable with this label of competition, and I think it goes back to what you were saying, you know, do you have to be evil to be a great competitor? Do you have to be cutthroat? Do you have to kill your mother and your sister and your best friend? And you didn't even have a best friend in the first place, right, because you're a competitor. But the reality is that that's just not true, and we are inspired by people like Michael Phelps, Michael Jordan. Great competitors make us go, wow, that's the best we can do, because they're picking and choosing when to compete and when to go for something and when to say, this isn't so much of a problem. And so we have these metaphors we write in the book, you know, there's the fire in the belly or the ice in the veins and all these great things. But once you start using that word competition, people start going, oh, do I have to, you know, again, kill my mother? And so we started thinking, well, you know, where did this come from? And is this sort of a universal issue? You know, I looked at multiple language dictionaries everywhere I possibly could. And at the same time, we started thinking actually about the ancient Greeks, because the Greeks were really the first culture to celebrate competition as an element of society. And I was fascinated to read about the concept of aretas, which is mistranslated often. If you see it, people will say excellence. You might also see an alternate spelling of it being arete, but that's just a different verb conjugation.
Let me just tell people it's aretas if they want to look that up.
Right.
So
and it sort of rhymes with gravitas.
Right.
So aretas was fascinating to me because in the American culture when we're worried, you know, that every time we hear about a political scandal or someone bilking another billion people out of money on Wall Street, oh, look, see, competition means bad behavior. And the Greek concept of aretas was that competition actually teaches moral behavior, and that it was in a competition that someone was challenged to draw upon all of the knowledge they had learned. They were challenged to become a leader, to show courage, to be fleet of foot, to come up with problem solving and strategy, and push forward in new ways that they had never anticipated before, and to use this then to inspire everyone else. So they actually thought it was these moments of competition that taught moral behavior, because that was when you really learned who you were and how to be a responsible person, to be a contributing leader. And, you know, it's easy to sit in our little comfy couches and say, well, yes, I would be a great leader. I would show character. But it's not until you're tested that you really have that idea. And I think it's sort of fascinating I mean, it's the polar opposite of the concern. Competition obviously brings immoral behavior, right? Competition teaches morality. But I do think, you know, it's those Olympic moments when, you know, someone does a spectacular performance and wins, but we all know that they just broke their leg and they're in incredible pain. Or in the Sochi Olympics, to me, one of the most memorable moments was when a guy, his ski broke. So people from another Olympic team ran on to give him replacements. They didn't try and tear him down. They said, we want him to do the best he can, and we're going to do the best he can. And that's when competition is inspiring. It's not when we're tearing each other up, but when we're all using each other as examples to push us to where we could never even imagine who we were.
I love these distinctions, you know, and I find that I looked at my life while reading this book, and I realized that, you know, it would be better if I sometimes write at a cafe like I used to. I have this darling little dog, and I'm basically like the worst helicopter parent, except that it's a dog. I stay home. I don't like to leave her. I take her in a little case at the drugstore. It's really totally pathetic. But it was really important for me to be around all these successful screenwriters, TV writers. They mostly don't write what I do, but they were succeeding because mm-hmm. I find that you want to catch up with them, even if you're doing something different, just that they are having something, you know, my show's on TV tonight. And that's sort of what you're describing with some of these, the Olympic contests and other mm-hmm. contests. This, you know, to have a peer group to compete with is very important.
Well, you know, everyone thinks that competition is about winning and losing, which is understandable, right? Not much of a surprise. In fact, when we actually wrote that would be the subtitle of the book, The Science of Winning and Losing, a bunch of people were like, well, can't it just be The Science of Winning? Because I'm not really into that losing thing. And I was like, no, you have to have both. Sorry. But focusing on the win and the loss misses the actual point. And as I researched this, what I realized is the benefit of competition isn't the outcome of a specific contest. Sure, you enter a contest thinking, I'm going to win, most of the time. If you know you're going to lose, you're probably not really going to be that motivated, right? But the benefit of competition is that it's challenging you and that you improve in the moment and over time, right? So we write in the book about Jason Lezak and the U.S. swim team in Beijing Olympics. And there, Jason did this sort of amazing come from behind, beats the world record time to win, and that means that the Americans can win, which means that Michael Phelps beats Mark Spitz's record, and on and on. But five of the eight teams finished ahead of the world record. The fifth team didn't come home with a world record. They didn't come home with a medal. But I believe to the depths of my soul that they thought, we just did something no one else in the world has ever done before. The next competition, the next thing we do, what you tell us is our limits, we reject because we know we can do more. And that's what the benefit of competition is challenging yourself to do more. So a more, you know, plebeian example is I have this broken elliptical that I got at a thrift store in my apartment. And when I'm not using it to dry laundry, which is really its primary purpose, I'll be watching, you know, reruns of NCIS, and I'm on my elliptical going, ooh, look at me working out. I'm so proud. It's not until I go to a gym that I know what a real workout is. So I don't go to the gym because I don't want to know, right? I know that I'm shielding myself and stopping myself from actually testing what I think I can do. And that's, you know, I mentioned a couple of athletic contexts, but it absolutely applies in a writing career. It applies in any career. You know, why is someone else getting a promotion and I didn't? Why did that guy ask her out and I didn't? You know, any different context, it's using other people not to tear them down, but as reference points to challenge what you think you can do. You may go, wow, I'm doing really well. Kudos for me. But you might say, oh, I could do something differently, or I could do something more. But that's what we're doing, is we're building off of people. We're not tearing each other down.
I just have to confess to feeling snotty and superior to you in that moment because you confessed to watching NCIS.
I love NCIS. NCIS. Most of the world does. It's the world's most famous show, right?
I know. Actually, if you know the TV I watch, Greg is horrified because I read all this great, important, you know, complicated science, and then my brain just wants to go flop, and so I watch all these sort of crappy crime shows, and anyway, I am a terrible person, so, but I just, I like that moment. Anyway.
I do the same thing. I write and read about, you know, in scientific papers and stuff like that all the time, and it's fun just to have some characters scratching their head over a problem, and, it's fun, and I'm a lawyer, so... You know, any police procedural stuff, I always get a kick out of.
I love that. I love the words that you use in Top Dog to distinguish between the different kinds of competitiveness. You say that there's a distinction between adaptive competitiveness and maladaptive. That's where we go along. It's with that vocabulary problem I started talking about before that you write about. And I just wanted to say what you described so you don't have to remember all this. You say adaptive competitiveness. Oh, you do? Well, then you tell it. Okay.
Of course I remember.
What's adaptive versus maladaptive?
Just not that I'm not competitive, but the reason you have to watch NCIS or an action show while working out is because it increases testosterone. If you were going to watch something like golf or Downton Abbey, it wouldn't help testosterone, and the testosterone would actually help you build muscle mass. So it's actually a more effective workout if you're watching. It's not as effective as if you were watching boxing or something, but I don't like to watch boxing, so I'm watching this. That's with chase scenes. So adaptive and maladaptive, that was probably an incident of maladaptive competitiveness on my part. maladaptive competitiveness is when you compete with the same ferociousness for everything, whether it's getting a job interview, getting a promotion, getting a parking space at the mall. You're going to kill someone if you don't get that space. And that's the woman who is killing people at the board game at the house. And everyone's like, I don't really want to play with her anymore because she's just lost it. This is just a game. And people who are maladaptively competitive not just have that focus that they have to win, but they believe they're entitled to the win. It's a foregone conclusion. And this is really important because if you believe you're entitled to the win, how you get there isn't important. You could cheat, but if you believed you were entitled to the win, well, then it's no big deal to cheat because the result would have been the same, right? The other people who are making the rules, they're the bad guys because they're slowing down the inevitable success you're going to have. So that's the sort of maladaptive competitiveness. But the good news for us is that most of us are adaptively competitive. We do pick and choose which things we're going to compete, which ones are like, so not worth my time. We do respect the other people who are competing, and we respect the rules, and we don't take that win for granted. And if we focus on the benefit is improvement, then we see we don't have to win. What we have to do is respect our growth and the other growth of other people and have that inspirational moment going.
Yeah, I find that very interesting, and it really debunks a lot of the myths, as you do in the book, throughout the book. I am speaking with science writer Ashley Merriman. Her book, co-authored with Poe Bronson, it's New York Times bestselling, and it is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. So now I want to talk about the company we keep and how that affects competition. You tell a story in the book about an idea researchers had about how to arrange all the West Point grads into groups.
Air Force Academy.
Sorry about that. Based on the notion that high performers rub off on low performers, sort of dragging them upward. But what happened?
Right. Well, this was, there were natural experiments that had preceded that sort of idea, which was that Dartmouth dorms, and they have, you know, suite arrangements in Dartmouth, and they found that the high-achieving Dartmouth students, and they're Dartmouth, there are no low achievers, right, but that the high-achieving people actually pull up the grades of their friends who were lower achieving. So they said, we have a problem at the Air Force in that a lot of kids drop out, the Air Force is really, I mean, the selection process, these are not, you know, casual kids who get in, right? You have to have a congressional nomination. You have to have the grades. You have to have the SAT. It's always considered one of the best schools in the country, but a lot of people drop out, and they underperform. So they said, well, how do we fix this? And one of the ideas was, can we arrange the squadrons and the classes, because they all study together, live together, work together, everything, in a way that sort of was with that Dartmouth idea. So we'll put the low performers and the high performers together. And statistically, that meant the middle performers had to go someplace, which was their own little area by themselves. But no one's really thinking about them. They want. And what they found, actually, was that this arrangement didn't affect the high performers. The high performers are just high performers. But the low performers, rather than inspiring them to do better, the goal of the competition and the better for the competition, rather than inspiring them, the low performers actually got even worse grades. They weren't flunking out just because of this, but they weren't getting better grades. They were getting a little bit worse. And the researchers looked and found that the low performers were actually self-segregating. They were looking at the guys who were high performers, and there were too many of them in class, right? So you can't just ignore that one guy who's a star, right? Half of the class seems like they're geniuses. And the low performers hid from it because they just couldn't handle the competition of being told day after day, you're nothing compared to these other guys. And the difference between the Air Force chosen squadrons and the Dartmouth was just a group of random people. And a random group has differences in ability, but each one sort of makes up for it. You know, you're the class clown, I'm the nerd, you'll teach me how to be funny, I'll teach you how to study. And by picking and choosing just on grades and assigning people into these groups, you didn't have those different strengths and weaknesses. Instead, the difference between the low and the high was just too great, and the low people gave up. So the middle performers, actually, their grades improved because the middle grader performers all hung out with each other and went, that's your grade? Well, I can do better than that. It wasn't so unattainable that they would give up. Instead, they were all just sort of, because that's what you want to do for a competition. You want your competition to be just a little bit better than you. You want a close race. You know, you don't want the one behind, because that would encourage you to slow down. So you want someone just close enough that you're like, oh, I could maybe catch him. But he'll look at you and go, ooh, and then he'll move further. So that's when great competition, and that's when that productive element is kicking in.
Yeah, I'm reminded of my dad playing tennis. You know, if you play with somebody just slightly better than you, then you feel that it's possible to maybe kick their ass at some point, which brings
right.
me to my next question. You say that for most of us, competitive fire, which is very important, is usually impacted by what we feel our odds of success are. This very interesting example of teens, when they take it the SAT in big venues,
mm-hmm.
With lots of other test takers, they score worse. So
right.
talk
the
a little
more
bit about
kids,
that.
The more kids taking the SAT at the same place at the same time, the lower everyone scores. And, yeah, we'll say that again because it's a little tricky. It's totally what? The more students who take the SAT at the same venue at the same time, the lower everyone scores. And Steve Garcia and Avershalom Tor, who are researchers who've studied this, and they've controlled for family education, family economics, funding of schools by states, and there's about 12 different fundings. They've controlled for SAT and ACT and all of that, and it still holds. And they've done experiments at the University of Michigan. They have incoming freshmen all take basically a version of an IQ test. And the more students who take the IQ test at the same place, at the same time, the lower everyone's IQ. And what they say is that competition is personal. And, you know, like that old expression about losing someone in the crowd? I always thought of that in terms of I'm at the edge of the crowd and I'm trying to find you because you're somewhere in there. But this actually says that it's really the reverse. You lose yourself in the crowd because you can't figure out who's your reference point. what you want is a kid saying, ooh, you're going to kick my butt on the math portion of the SAT, but I know all the vocabulary, so I think I can take you there. And those reference points then keep you feeling like this is doable and in a concrete way. But the more people you compete against, the more you're saying, well, all these people all want to go to the same school as me? I can't do that. So they all start giving up.
Well, I had an idea about this. So, because I've been reading a lot about and thinking a lot about reframing things. And I thought, well, maybe if we're in that sort of situation, and this is where you're in a big room competing, you're taking a test, the GRE, the something, the SAT,
right,
with a lot of other people, to try to narrow the field in our head. Because our brains, they're lazy and they believe us when we say these things. It sounds so stupid and unbelievable, but that when we give it a new idea, reframe things. So my idea is, what if we see ourselves, for example, as competing only against all the redheads in the room? And the last stat I read on that, that redheads are 1 in 40 in the population. So you're competing against three people, maybe, if it's a huge room, instead of 300. So
right,
that might help us fool our brains into being better competitors.
Well, Steve Garcia actually says, and in some ways I think this sounds too easy too, but it makes sense, which is at a certain point you have to remind yourself it's only your grade that matters to you, and that you're competing against yourself. So don't worry about the fact that there are 10 other people in the room or 100 people in the room. Ultimately, it's about you and the paper. So you focus your attention back on the task and not how many people are there. And it's interesting, when Poe and I were doing an adaptation of the piece for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, we interviewed some young men who had just done the SAT, and they said that that was literally happening, that they would sit up in the room in the middle of the test and say, oh, my God, these guys all want to get to UCLA, too? I can't do this. And they were so freaked out, they retook the test, and they mentally refused to look up. And they said, all I need to do is get better than my score the last time. And they got in.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. It's great that they thought that way. Now, my producer Greg Sutter is going to love this question because he watches a lot of sports and listens to sports radio. So, tell us about the home field advantage in competition. It's actually not a myth, and it's not related to, you know, it isn't, oh, well, they didn't sleep well because they were traveling. It's something else.
Well, all of that's true. The NBA home team wins about 63% of the time. Different sports, the numbers are up and down, but home field advantage seems to be there. And what's fascinating, though, is, yes, sleep and travel seem to have an effect. Crowds seem to have an effect. A really loud, boisterous crowd will actually perhaps sway the umpire so that he, you know, lets the dubious call slide. But what's equally fascinating is, you know, there was a real problem with violence in the stands of Italian soccer games. And it was such a problem that the Italian parliament told the team owners that if any more fights happened in the stands, that they were going to pass a law that the team owners were liable for any hooliganism by the fans. Now, you can imagine what the team owners thought of that. Right? They didn't want to be responsible for what one random drunk fan did. So stadiums closed the games. Not a single person came. They would show them on TV, but not a single person in the stands, and there was still home field advantage. And my favorite example was actually a statistician, Richard Pillard, looked at teams in the United States that had moved from one old stadium to a new stadium. There's no travel. There's no different crowds. There's no different refs. They went to a better facility just across town, and they lost some of their home field advantage for at least the first year. So it turns out that home field advantage is about a sense of ownership, that this is mine, not yours. You better come and try and take it from me, but you can't, because this is mine. I got here first. But what's really crazy about the home field advantage, because I knew sports-wise people talk about it, but Graham Brown and researchers have found that it's just as operational in any business negotiation. And the home field advantage can get you, whether you're the buyer or the seller, up to about 160% more out of the value of the negotiation.
I want to describe that because this was so amazing to me. And I should say who I'm talking with. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. This is Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman's Top Dog. I'm talking with Ashley Merriman, and the subtitle of their book is The Science of Winning and Losing. So this is this incredible study where these students took part in a mock contract negotiation. The professor staggered the arrival of the students. The early arrivers got to go into the office early. He said, oh, use the computer, do what you want, hang a poster, decorate. So they had 20 minutes to get comfortable in the space before the other student arrived for the negotiation. And you say it wasn't even close in the negotiation.
No, it was about 160% more that they got. And, you know, this is one of those double blinds. So sometimes the person who was early was the seller. Sometimes they were later. And he's found in other work, Brown, that, you know, if you want a better raise, do it in your office. And I've told people that, and they all laugh at me and say, well, no one ever gets to ask for a raise in their office. And I said, I know. And then they look at me and go, oh. But it's true. Home field advantage, we understand that you got there first. And we defer to you, even if it's something as stupid as I sit in a conference room and I put my stuff down and I leave. Well, I didn't put my name on it. I may not even put my stuff down on that chair, but you come back. If I come back and you're in my chair, what happens? That's my chair. Get out. Right? So it's actually almost instantaneous. And I tell people, you know, who are going to a lunch business meeting, if you're the first person, you always kind of wonder, well, should I sit here and wait until the other person comes where the hostess is, or should I go out and, you know, sit down? Well, if it's a negotiation, you should sit down. You should learn the name of your server. You should rearrange the salt and pepper shakers and put it in a workspace so that you feel like this is yours, so that when they get there, they have to ask for permission to join you, and it will change the entire negotiation.
That is so incredible. I am never going to be late to any sort of lunch or meeting ever again. I will go naked. I'll just show up in a bra with wet hair. I'll wear ugly earrings. You know, I always think I'm leaving the house, you have to change the earrings. And, you know, they're not exactly the optimum earrings that I could wear in the universe at that moment. Forget that.
That does not matter. What matters is getting there first.
Yeah,
and if you showed up in a robe, that would just be proof that that was home and that that was how comfortable you were. So I actually think, you know, depending on the opaqueness of the robe, that might be the best way to go.
I love this.
A friend of mine, read the book and the home field advantage stuff, and she regularly has to pitch her boss on projects. You know, what thing are they going to do next? And she says that since this has happened, if she doesn't like it and just wants to talk about it, she goes to his office. If she really likes it, she has him come to her office.
She
said it's working.
Great. I love it. You know, it's science help, not self-help, which I stole from David DeSalvo, so I won't be a total
thief. Oh, that's awesome. I love that line.
I love that, too. I wanted to put in a proposal, but I realized I actually, you know, like you said, competition, morality, I couldn't do it without, you know, crediting him, and it seems sort of bad to be promoting other writers in your own book proposal. So.
competition. It's tough, isn't it?
It sure is, but, you know, it really does make you feel better when you behave well. But I want to move on because, you know, I talked about in the opening about choking. And very, very interesting research you write about in Top Dog on this. And Robert Zayant, which you taught me to pronounce before the show, he's a researcher. He found that a key variable in whether people were helped or hurt by having somebody there watching them, like the supportive boyfriend or your mom or whomever, was whether they were in the learning phase or had mastered something. That was one variable. There actually is another. But give us a little info on that.
Well, you definitely, there's, you know, always a question, I mean, are you an expert or a novice? And novices do worse with any kind of audience, any kind of competition, because they're just literally learning what to do. Experts are actually going to do better in competition. They're going to do better with an audience because it means they force them to actually do it well. Because an expert, something might be so easy they're just going to slide through. So that extra pressure is going to help them. So it's not, is it simply is there an audience or not, which is where the confusion, I think, was first. It's about the complexity of the task and the amount of experience you have. Of course, you can also throw in there's a teeny gender difference, which is kind of fun, which is that guys, when you're talking about the supportive boyfriend, that would not work. Leave him home. Guys, when asked to do a sort of stressful task in the lab, do better when they have a supportive partner, a girlfriend, a mom, a friend. They do better. But women actually do worse. And I think that's because the guys are actually looking at the support person as an actual support network, whereas the women are thinking, oh, my gosh, not only am I going to do this really badly and embarrass myself, I'm going to embarrass myself in front of someone I really care about. So they actually end up, rather than bring a support network, end up bringing another set of judges, another set of audience that they feel they have to perform well for. So they just really get struggled and frustrated with that.
Now, you get into some very interesting research on the differences between men and women in competition. And one thing that you bring out is how males spend most of their time in groups and females spend it in pairs from a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that this may be behind women's need to be hyper-rational and sure of a win before they compete, where guys are more risky, risk-taking-y. That's not quite a good way to say it, but you get what I mean.
First, my disclaimer, which is I did not want to write about gender differences in the book. In fact, when we first started talking about will we write a book about competition, Poe asked me, should we write about gender differences? And I said no. And as the girl, I got to win on that one. It was up to me. And the reason I said no was, well, twofold. One, I didn't want anyone to hold up top dog and say, see, this is the reason women aren't yet in the White House, women aren't running Wall Street, aren't, you know, are only 4% of venture capital funded companies, because they just can't compete. Did you read Ashley's book? Oh, no, I was not going to let that happen. But there was also this idea, well, when Poe and I wrote our previous book, Nurture Shock, we read about gender differences in results with kids and child development all the time. All the time. I mean, some journals won't even accept a paper to consider for publication unless you separately report girls and boys. You could say no difference, but you have to at least acknowledge that you've run the data. But the thing is, the difference based on gender would be, I don't know, sometimes it was as much as 3 or 4%. But on an individual basis, that's meaningless, right? 3 or 4%? You know, the difference between you and I is two humans, even though we're both women, we're both writers, there are other things that are going to make us different, right? So I could completely say and find a stack of studies and things, men have superior upper body strength, right? No one has a problem with that. Yeah, that makes sense. But if I'm standing next to Venus or Serena, I'm an idiot, right? So when you apply these gender differences to actual humans, it didn't make any sense. But then we found work by people like Muriel Niederle at Stanford, and she was finding in invitations to compete that 75% of the guys would say game on, and only about 35% of the women. 40% spread between who says yes to competition, who doesn't, and that's when Poe and I were like, ooh, okay, maybe we need to actually think about gender differences in competition. And there wasn't any research to support that women are less good at competition. If anything, they're as good or better. But they were more focused and concerned on whether or not they were going to win. Women refuse to waste time on losing. Guys assume they're going to win, so they don't care.
Can I put this the way you put it? Basically, in the book, you basically say men are more prone to overconfidence, basically. And this seems, a good way to describe it, because that tends to be what happens. They think it's like the bald guy who goes out and he has a comb over, but he thinks it looks like he has hair.
Well, you know, statistically, men are overconfident. I've got this. And women are underconfident. Oh, I don't have this. And so then the question, though, comes, where does this come from? And that's what we were talking about in terms of the groups and the pairs. And Joyce Benenson, a researcher, says that it is about how, in many ways, we grow up as little girls and little boys, which is little boys grow up in a pack, girls grow up in a pair. And these aren't small differences. If you put a room full of six-year-olds together and just say, play however you want, boys spend about 74% of their time in a group activity. Girls, it's about 16%. If you actually time the amount of time that the two boys talked to each other, it's half as long as the conversation of the two six-year-old girls. And my favorite, if you put two boys by themselves in a room and you force them to talk, do you know what they talk about?
Competing?
Well, you know, if we had a few more boys, we could play some really cool games. So a pair of boys want it to be a group. And so groups teach you, as I mentioned earlier, it's okay to have differences in ability. It's okay to have strengths and differences, and that hierarchy is no big deal. And it teaches kids that they can brag, right? If a bunch of kids are all meeting on the basketball court, somebody's allowed to say, throw it to me, I got this. Because otherwise, no one will know he's open, and they won't give him the ball. And they've signed on for this purpose, coming every day to play basketball, which means that the relationships they have are not important. As long as you commit to the purpose, if you're here every day to play basketball, we want you here. And the fact that two boys are arguing, well, shut up and pass the ball, because you're not here to hold hands. You're here to play ball. So there are other people refereeing this and staying on this focus of the purpose. But girls grow up in a pair, and the purpose is the relationship. The purpose is the friendship. And there's no neutral mediator. There's no purpose to look past the relationship. So girls end up being self-policing, and they end up liking whatever it is the best friend likes. Right? You like pepperoni? Of course I love pepperoni. Oh, I knew you would because you're my friend. Well, of course I'm your friend. So it's about sameness. And girls in this pair dynamic learn over time that to compete means to risk losing your very best friend. And if you're going to lose your best friend, well, you better at least come home with a trophy. So they start only competing when they know they're going to win, and they only compete when it's really important. And these patterns then persist over time. So college-educated, affluent women, they've done studies and find that they never discuss their achievements, they never discuss their accomplishments with someone unless they know the person they're talking to is equally or more successful than they.
Now, I wonder, this is just an opinion of mine, is it possible that the boys gravitate to groups thing and girls are in dyads, groups of two? Why, and again, this is my opinion, that I find that more women than men, and I say this as an advice columnist who gets angry mail from people, more women than men seem wounded by mere ideas. And there's, I find that there's a general growing inability to debate things in this country. But that's my experience, that women are deeply offended if you have a different idea, more so than men are likely to be.
Well, absolutely, because to voice an opinion that's different means that you've broken the social compact, which is we're self-policing, right? The goal of any pair, you could put the most ardent Obama and the most ardent Limbaugh fan in a room together. They don't start attacking each other. They try and find common ground. Gosh, isn't the weather lovely? Or whatever it is. So a pair is about finding common ground. And when you're willing to say, I disagree, it's not just about the topic, but saying, I'm not valuing you. I'm not valuing the relationship. So Joyce has actually found in research that women, unlike men, prophylactically ostracize because they anticipate you might at some point disagree with me or get the promotion that I was supposed to get, or a promotion and I won't get one, or you have better shoes than I do. So they cut you out beforehand because they're not going to wait for you to actually do that breach. And but this is, I think, really important. Benenson studied 14-year-old girls, and she asked them, you know, how would you feel if your best friend had, you know, better grades than a boyfriend? And you didn't. Ooh, they don't like that at all. No, that's very, very upsetting to a 14-year-old girl. And then she said, okay, well, what if you had the better grades than the boyfriend? And the girls were just as upset. It wasn't that their girlfriend was doing better than them. It was that they are supposed to be the same. So, absolutely, you know, I keep joking. There's always that classic scene in a movie where the guy crushes your company, walks in, says, you know, it's not personal, it's just business. I can't even imagine a woman doing that. I don't know if guys do that in real life, but it wouldn't even work as a movie scene for women because it's always personal. Ann Kramer, author about women's relationships in the workplace, titled her book, It's Always Personal.
Now, is there a way women can be encouraged to be more competitive? Can understanding this dyad thing, how women are likely to fall into dyads, help women become better, sort of gravitate to groups and become better competitors?
I definitely think all of that's true. But I also think, you know, other things can help. You know, you have to, you know, you were talking about reframing. I was talking to a woman and I said, you know, you've got to go for things and you've got to try for a job that you want. And she came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, there was this job, and she was not a 19-year-old, this is my first job, right? Mid-career executive, more fashionably put together than I will ever be, just, you know, perfectly together. She said there was a job she really wanted to apply for the previous week, but she only had 7 of the 10 qualifications, so she didn't apply. I said, okay, why are you assuming everyone who did apply had more than 7 of the 10? Why are you assuming that the one qualification you have, they didn't even know to ask, that's the least important when it could be the most important? And I'm like, and most of all, it's not your job to say no. It's your job to say, here's my idea. Here's what I can offer. Does this work for you? They'll tell you no if they need to. But it's not your job to say no. And that was that hyper concern. She didn't even apply because she'd done the odds calculation and said, I'm not going to win, so I'm not even going to apply. And women need to be encouraged. I mean, some guys might need to be told, hey, coffee, smell it, you're not going to win. But women, you know, we don't want to be Pollyanna about this, but women especially need to be encouraged and said, this is not your one shot, that you need to be able to go for things, whether it's pitching an idea in a business meeting or, you know, applying for a job that you're not sure you're right for. And I'm like, if thinking I'm never going to get this job, I shouldn't even apply, I'm never going to get this job, this is stupid, then you reframe it into something you can be successful at. Okay, I'm probably not going to get this job, but I need some practice on my interview skills, and I want to meet these people, so it'll be working on networking. Because now you've reframed it, you know you're going to win. You know you're going to get at least that much out of it.
That is so important. That is so important. My mom actually taught me something great. My mom's the chattiest person in the world, and I'll always go to an interview just to talk to people. Not that I'm interviewing anymore, but because I have this, you know, I'm writing. But she also said, say yes to everything and figure out how to do it before you have to come through. And,
right.
And that's a sort of – that's an orientation I see men more likely to have than women, and especially
Definitely.
Per what you're talking about here.
And I mean, it's not just, you know, and all of this is easy to say, but it's very context specific. I mean, we write in Nurture Shock, I mean, not in Nurture Shock, we do it in there too, but in Top Dog, we, you know, an entrepreneur has to go for it. As an entrepreneur, you can't sit around and do an odds calculation about the success of your company because it's not going to be successful, right? I mean, it's just not. Every company, every startup is not the next Google. So as an entrepreneur, you have to set aside the likelihood of success and say, this is something I believe in, this is something I have to do, and we're going to go for it. If you're going to be sitting on a company's audit committee, I want you to get your odds right. I want you to make sure that you didn't make a mistake. If you're a Wall Street financial analyst, women are 7.3% more accurate than the guys because they want their numbers to be ironclad. So it's a context-specific thing, and I'm not saying everyone should just willy-nilly jump into every risky situation, but if you see an opportunity for growth, then you have to say, hey, can we do this? And set aside that concern over the win and the loss. And remember, it's about improvement. And if you see that avenue, well, I can improve, even if I fail miserably, but I've learned from the experience, and it might be worth doing.
So when we come back, I want to just tell people who I'm talking to and what your book is, but we'll talk about playing to win versus playing not to lose, diametrically opposing strategies. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is New York Times bestselling science writer Ashley Merriman, and her book, which I loved, co-authored with Poe Bronson, that we're discussing tonight, is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. So you talk about gain orientation, which pushes you to take risks to get something that you don't already have, versus prevention orientation, which pushes you to avoid danger. So talk a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned playing to win versus playing not to lose. And, you know, you hear those as sports metaphors on TV shows all the time. But what's interesting is that they're really fundamentally different strategies that affect everything. So someone who's playing to win, someone who's in that gain prevention mindset, they're focusing on not just the victory, but everything that's going to come with it. The Olympian isn't focused on just the gold medal, but the endorsement deals and the fact that Obama may call for congratulations and blah, blah, blah. If you're playing to win and you want a job promotion, you're not just thinking, I'm going to get a new title. You're thinking, I'm going to get a new title. I'm going to get a new raise and a better parking space, and my mom is going to be so proud, and I'm going to meet new people and have this new social circle. So there's this universe of great things that come with the success. And because you have that big picture of what the success is, it's worth going for it, right? And because it's worth going for it, you're going to take risks because the value of the risk, it's a no-brainer. Why would you pass up this opportunity? And then you're thinking, okay, so how do I keep going? You benefit best from praise, right? Because you're taking risks, you're doing things. You want to hear people telling you what you did right so you can keep doing it. You don't want to hear negative comments because those are just slowing you down. And you work better under time pressure, because the faster you go, the sooner you get to your goal, right? If you're playing not to lose, if you're in that sort of prevention orientation, you're not focused on all of the good things that come with a success. Instead, you're just preventing disaster. How badly is this going to go? And you're worried then you're not going to take risks, because those are just going to ensure mistakes. And that's what's going to trip you up. That's what's going to make you lose. So your focus then is on preventing mistakes. And someone who's focused on preventing mistakes, they don't want to hear praise, like the guy who's playing to win. They want to hear negative feedback, because what they want to hear is, what am I doing wrong so I can fix it? They've got to master every detail and dot every I and cross every T, because it's those one tiny little dot that they missed. That's what's going to become their undoing. And they're going to work better when there's no time pressure, because they need more time to master those details, take care of everything. So, again, when you're talking about context, you know, the entrepreneur's got to play to win. But I want my engineers to play not to lose. I don't want my engineer to look and say, well, it's a beautiful skyline. I'm sure it'll hold in the next earthquake. I want them to know where every bolt goes and to know it holds. So that's really important, because everyone's like, oh, well, then I want to play to win. I don't want to play to not to lose. That must be for losers. And the reality is we need both, right? I want my attorneys to play not to lose. I want my reporters to be playing to win, brave, find the story, But they also got it not to lose. They got to be right, right? I want them to nail the details. I want to nail the details in my own work, right? But the other thing to learn and understand about playing not to lose is it's not for losers. The number one guy in the world who's walking down the hall thinking, everyone's just waiting for me to screw up, he's playing not to lose. He's going, oh, my gosh, at some point I will screw up. And the only question is, am I going to be number two or am I going to be the laughing stock of the world? So it's easy to say we're going to start playing to win, but once you get in the reality of what you have to do and expectations, that's when you often switch to that playing not to lose mindset. But it ends up being fear-based, and you end up forgetting why you did something in the first place, which was because you loved it, because of all those great things you knew were going to come.
And you have this great advice. I want to get to be sure we get to the worriers versus warriors, but I love this. You talk about labeling something a challenge rather than a threat to avoid going into prevention mode, because the fear really does freeze you in that. And
right.
Then you can't really prevent anything. You're just sitting there shaking.
Well, a challenge is something that, you know, victory, success is not assured, but you have the skills, you have the talent, you have the resources that you honestly think, I've got a good chance of winning. I have a good chance of succeeding. It's not taken for granted. If it was taken for granted, you might not work hard enough to actually get there. But you think you can do it. And that threat situation is when you don't have the skills, you don't have it, you're in the wrong field. So, like the Air Force Academy, all those other guys were so far ahead in electrical engineering, you just stopped trying. So you want to focus on it being a challenge, because that's an opportunity to show what you can do rather than a test of your abilities. And researchers have done, you know, small lab things, and they find that, you know, students will do a 90% score when it's a challenge frame, but drop to a 70% in a threat situation because they're feeling so judged and it's scary. And there's actually physiological changes that happen between the challenge and threat state. Your heart rate variability changes, your blood circulation changes. So to have that challenge state is about energizing yourself to go forward, whereas a threat state is, oh, my God, how do I get out of this alive?
Yes. Now, we have 4 minutes left, but I really want to get to this. It's this great counterintuitive chapter title, How the Warriors, as in People Who Worry, Can Beat the Warriors, as in People with Spears. Well, I guess not now, but so tell us about that.
Well, the research has actually found that there's a genetic variant that regulates how much dopamine sort of is recycled, the rate of recycling, basically, in the prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is where, you know, higher levels of thought, planning, that kind of thing are. And they found that this COMT gene variant changes so that these people who on an average day have, you know, a much slower rate of turnover, so they basically got more dopamine in the brain, they have higher working memory, higher spatial abilities, and a bunch of great thinking things because they got more dopamine activating their brain. And the people with this other variant, they're underwhelming. But in periods of stress, the pattern actually flips. And those people who had been doing well on the average day, we call them the worriers, they melt down. It's like a car engine flooding with gas. There's just too much dopamine in the brain because the stress is already adding to the dopamine. Whereas the people who had the other variant, the warriors, actually do their best in a stressful situation because now the dopamine in their brain is actually optimal. And so often people say, oh, well, I'm a warrior, but does that just mean I, you know, pack it up and go home? And the research says that that's not true because over time, warriors don't change their genotype, right? They're still going to be stress puppies, right? But they will be. But in a particular task that they practice, they become used to the stress, and then their sort of natural advantage and working memory and all those other things comes back. So that's how the warriors can then beat the warriors, because through practice and mastering the skills, they still are prone to stress, but in particular contexts, they don't let it hold them back.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I see this in research on choking in general in sports, about practice really being the thing to get you out. Now, we have about 1 minute left, so just leave us with some final words of wisdom. And just to tell everyone, this is Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is New York Times bestselling science writer Ashley Merriman. Her book, co-authored with Poe Bronson, is Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. So final words of wisdom.
No pressure. That's a threat situation right there. Miracle wisdom. How about just greetings and salutations? To me, it really is all about challenge and threat. And this is not a book, and I don't want anything in my conversations to be about, you know, there are top dogs and everybody else is just done. It's about looking at competitions and situations and finding out how do you do your best. So you may say, ooh, I'm a warrior. I do great, but when it's game day, I flip out. Okay, well then you don't want an acute competition. You want longer-term things where you can master those details. You may be a warrior saying, you know, I probably should go into crisis management because that's really where I rise. So it's looking at the environment to find out what brings out your best and to see if there are other things that are in the worst. And in the meantime, keep saying, this is a challenge. This is an opportunity to learn and to grow. I don't have to win. As long as I have experienced something and had that improvement, it's worth doing. And that's what great competition is about, and that's why we inspire ourselves and inspire each other.
Wow. Thank you, Ashley Merriman. Great show. Love talking to you tonight, and I learned a lot from your book, Tough Dog.
Oh, thank you.
Gives a happy meal its smile. Is it the delicious four-piece chicken McNuggets with no artificial colors or preservatives? The kid-sized fries? The apple slices? Or the low-fat milk? Maybe.